coming up.
California will be allowed to oversee the health care for inmates at Folsom Prison nearly a decade after the state lost control of prison medical services amid allegations of substandard care in the correctional system.
Convicted felons forfeit their right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Do they also forfeit their right to health?
In order to get in here, they're pretty sick. They're dying. So you're dealing with them knowing that no matter what you do, you're not helping them to live.
What kind of patients' rights should convicted felons have?
I'll get out of here one of these days in a box.
Take one last look at the prison yard.
We have a long way to go when it comes to taking care of inmates who are terminally ill.
Our guest is Oscar-nominated director Edgar Behrens.
Dignity denied, life and death in prison. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University, where Ken teaches philosophy and I did for 40 years.
40 amazing years, John. Our topic today, dignity denied, life and death in prison.
Now, there's a lot of philosophical issues connected with this topic. But before plunging into those, we're going to talk a little bit about the facts. Because of very harsh sentencing laws, like three strikes and mandatory minimums, the U.S. imprisons a huge number of people, many serving life terms without the possibility of parole.
In fact, we have 1/4 of the world's total prison population, and we're not even 5% of the world's total population, John.
Our prison population is also rapidly aging. They're getting sicker and sicker as they get older. It's not like prisoners get the best health care anyway. Many die unnecessarily, alone in their cells, from cancer, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, in many cases treatable problems.
You know, John, it all sounds to me, frankly, like cruel and unusual punishment, and so should be prohibited. But, you know, the problem is, I guess it's not really unusual given how frequently we imprison people for such long times.
Well, the only reasonable interpretation of the Eighth Amendment is that any punishment which is either cruel or unusual is prohibited.
Good luck getting that passed. Your favorite Supreme Court Justice, Antonin Scalia, that's how he interprets it, not at all.
Don't get me started on that fallacious, manipulative mountebank.
Well, you know, you have a point there. But, you know, even so, the Eighth Amendment isn't entirely toothless. We no longer hang people in this country. We deem that cruel and unusual. We deem the electric chair cruel and unusual. And now there's actually a raging debate over whether certain drugs that are sometimes administered in the death penalty cases are cruel and unusual. So there's a debate.
Yeah, there's these drugs that paralyze the inmate while he dies a slow and painful death. Now, frankly, I think being hung would be a day in the park compared to dying that way. I don't think there should be any real controversy here.
You know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say you're probably not a fan of the death penalty in any form. But what about all these long-term sentences, life without the possibility of parole at the max? You think that's any more humane? Is that cruel and unusual or not?
Well, Ken, imagine a young man in his 20s commits a pretty bad crime. Maybe it sells drugs or even worse. He gets convicted to life in prison without parole. Now it's 40 years later. The guy spent most of his life behind bars, where he's become a completely different person. Maybe he's read the Bible. Maybe he's read great philosophers. Maybe he's teaching courses to other inmates. Eventually, he develops a terminal illness and is given just a few months to live. The most humane thing to do here would surely be to release him and let him die in dignity and peace with his family. He's already paid the price for his crime. Anything else is just cruel.
I see your point. But, you know, there are these programs, they're not everywhere, where terminally ill patients can apply for what's called compassionate release. That's a start. So there is some hope, you know.
Well, yeah, but good luck getting that to work. Even where there are such programs, because of the huge backlog of applications, most prisoners still die alone in their cells before their cases are even processed.
John, are you trying to make me depressed to start this program?
Oh, well, that's always fun. But I'll make you more depressed. Just consider who is getting these harsh sentences in the first place. Many of them are nonviolent drug offenders who are disproportionately young men of color or mentally ill. Did you know, Ken, that there are actually more mentally ill people in prisons in this country than there are in psychiatric facilities?
Wow, that's an astounding statistic.
Yeah. Hospitals are being closed while more prisons are being built, sometimes by profitable corporations, to incarcerate people who are already marginalized. And what kind of care do you suppose they get once they're inside?
Well, health care in prison is a tricky thing. Prisoners are entitled to adequate health care, but, you know, sometimes it actually takes a lawsuit to get things really moving. And we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to talk to a doctor at a major California prison about how health care in prison has changed over the years in the Golden State. She files this report.
On a typical day, Rene Alvarez heads out of his house in Oakland, California, and drives straight to prison. Alvarez is a primary care doctor at a major state prison in Northern California. He asks us to not disclose which one. Alvarez says when he started working in the prison health system, it was, to say the least, broken.
When I first arrived there, it was very challenging. It was clear what was not working, but it wasn't clear how to fix it.
That was in 2007. 6 years earlier, California was sued after 32 inmates around the state died because of a lack of adequate health care. The state promised sweeping changes, but a few years later, not much had improved.
In California, lawmakers are lamenting the state of health care and the state's huge prison system, and they want to know why a health care system that costs $1 billion a year is plagued with incompetent doctors and unexplained deaths.
There were people dying of asthma inside their cells who couldn't get access to care in time. There were problems getting people the medicines they needed. There were a shortage of physicians and nurses.
So California began a receivership program, sending officials into state prisons to make sure changes were being made. And it worked.
I guess change doesn't happen unless it's made to happen.
In the prison where Alvarez works, they replaced a lot of the medical staff.
Physicians who had been there a long time, who weren't very effective, who weren't necessarily even board certified or skilled.
They also added new healthcare resources.
We have a pharmacy and we have a laboratory there that does the blood draws. We have x-ray machines, we have an MRI and CT scanner truck.
They're also dealing head-on with the epidemic of hepatitis C in their prison. Today, one in every six prisoners nationwide has hep C, compared to about 1 in 100 for the general population.
There's pretty much, they had a perfect storm of risk for transmitting hepatitis C between intravenous drug use, rampant tattooing with maybe unclean needles.
Alvarez says his prison recently began treating hepatitis C patients with a new and very expensive drug.
It's about $1,000 a pill, and they're getting them, the people who need them.
That's about $90,000 a patient, or over $1 billion if we were treating every prisoner with hep C in the country. Some might argue prisoners aren't worth that kind of investment. Not Rene Alvarez.
When someone walks into our office in the community, we are not asking them what they've done in their life. We are not judging them for their behavior. We believe that everyone is entitled to medical care and to be healthy and to have their diseases treated. And the courts have been very clear as well that if people are going to be in the custody of the state, then it is the state's responsibility to provide them with adequate health care.
There's also the public health risk of spreading diseases like hepatitis C after inmates are released. Alvarez says California is on the vanguard of showing how to do prison health care the right way.
It's quite remarkable what has been accomplished, and hopefully other states will see what's happened here and not wait for the lawsuit to happen and start to fix their healthcare systems.
Alvarez says the system isn't perfect. They're dealing with a prison after all. For instance, the prison cells are too small to even do jumping jacks. so not much exercise. But at least people are no longer dying in their prison cells from a lack of medical care. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thank you, Shuka, for that very interesting continuing the mood of the show, somewhat depressing, but with a little good news at the end. Report. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're asking about dignity rights and life and death in prison. We're joined now by Edgar Behrens. He's a filmmaker whose 2013 documentary, wonderful documentary, you should go out and see it, Prison Terminal, The Last Days of Private Jack Hall, was nominated for an Academy Award. Edgar, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Edgar, your film, Prison Terminal, is a cinema verite style. It's a documentary that follows the last weeks of a prison inmate, Jack Hall, and the other inmates who work as hospice volunteers caring for him. So how did this crop up in your life? How did you get interested in making documentaries about prisons and death in prison?
Well, it goes back basically to my childhood. My parents were very political, and my brother and I were brought up to be, you know, kind of question authority. And my father was a very creative person as an artist. And when I went into filmmaking, I thought, well, I could go the Hollywood route, which would be very difficult, or I could do the documentary and doing more social issue documentaries and try to change, you know, systems that are not working very well. So long story short, I made a short film when I was working for the Open Society Institute in New York City on a hospice program down in Louisiana, namely at the Angola prison down there. And for that prison to have a progressive hospice program for their prisoners was absolutely unique, because if you know anything about prison history, Angola is probably one of the worst prisons in the country. So this is a program that was highlighted. We highlighted it at the Open Society Institute, and in order to like replicate it nationwide. So that was done in the late 90s. I felt like I needed to revisit the topic again, because the issue was much more severe as the years went by, and nothing really was changing.
Well, I'm really glad you did, and I don't know about your bank account, but in terms of social good, I'm sure your documentaries are a good choice for you to have made, rather than trying to hire Sylvester Stallone for a violent thriller or something.
I tried that; it didn't work.
It tried that. Yeah, he's hard to get a hold of. You know, in the last few decades, we've seen a lot of tough sentencing laws being passed. We're having second thoughts about those now. But they've been in effect for quite a while, and it's led to a huge increase in the prison population. Can you give us a few more facts about how this has changed prison demographics and also conditions on the ground for the inmates?
Yeah, just give us some highlights, though, not the whole story.
Well, I think you said it earlier in your intro, you know, with the three strikes are out and the truth in sentencing, we've basically doubled the prison population since the 1990s. And with that comes, you know, people are aging out. You know, the prisoners come to prison also with bad health care to begin with, because a lot of them didn't have anything on the outside prior to committing their crime. So they come to prison already their health is taxed. So we're dealing with kind of fixing that first, and then the fact that, you know, once you're in prison, I think technically you age 7 to 10 years faster than the free person on the outside. So, you know, because of the stress of surviving in prison.
So we're locking up lots of people for lots of different things. We lock up more people for more things for longer periods than any place else in the developed world. But so they're sick, they're old, they've got disproportionate amount of mental illness. Right, so it's and then we don't really treat these people all that well, I gather. Is that right? Once they're in prison?
Well, you know, I think the correctional health care situation, you know, there's some great facilities, but for the most part, I think they miss the mark. You know, they're just keeping up with stuff, you know, and a lot of times a lot of people do fall through the cracks. Like you said earlier, many people die in prison of things that normally would not cause death on the outside. So it's kind of a dicey system. It's not cut and dry.
We're going to have to dig deeply into the justice of and injustice of this dicey system when we return. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about life and death in prison with filmmaker Edgar Behrens.
When you're convicted of a crime, you lose some rights, like the right to move about freely, the right to decide when and what you eat, when you sleep and exercise, and in many cases, the right to vote. But there are limits. You can't just kill prisoners willy-nilly, for example. So where do we draw the line? What rights should convicted criminals forfeit, and which rights are inalienable, even when you go to jail?
Crime, punishment, and human rights, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone.
Well, when you're stuck in prison, you forfeit your right to liberty and, to a certain degree, the pursuit of happiness. But what rights should no one, even convicted felons, forfeit? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about dignity, rights, life and death in prison.
Our guest is Edgar Behrens. He's director of the Oscar-nominated documentary Prison Terminal: The Last Days of Private Jack Hall.
So, speaking of The Last Days of Private Jack Hall, I watched that documentary. I was very moved. It showed how things might be in prison, because it was a very dignified death that this guy, Private Jack Hall, endured. And you're very focused, it seems to me, on how we might preserve the basic human dignity of prisoners. But let me ask you, I'm a philosopher trying to find a principle. How does thinking about dignity help us figure out which rights prisoners ought to be given and which rights they might forfeit? Because, you know, losing your liberty is an affront to dignity. So, I mean, how does thinking about dignity help us find a principle?
Well, I think, you know, after you commit a crime, whether it's nonviolent or violent, I think the fact that you're being put in prison and losing your freedom is the right that you're losing. But prolonged torture once you're in prison is probably not human. It violates human rights, I think, your human rights. So that's why I think when you said earlier that healthcare is a human right, there is no way we should deny healthcare, standard healthcare, to a prisoner just because they lost their freedom or they committed a crime, no matter how heinous or, you know, even nonviolent.
But I'm a skeptic, could say to you. I'm not really a skeptic about this, but a skeptic could say to you, wait a minute. You know, healthcare is a really complicated thing. I mean, basic minimal healthcare, maybe, but more than basic minimal healthcare. And then we have this trouble as a society determining, you know, what's basic minimal healthcare. That's like one of the most fraught things for the non-convicted. So for the convicted, what do you say
absolutely
to those people?
Well, you know, and I have heard people say, like, you know, I can't even – my grandmother can't even get a hip replacement, and here we're, like, putting a liver in somebody who in prison who needs a new liver. And I know there are certain limits, I think, that we should put on. But, you know, that's a tough line to draw. The truth is, if our healthcare on the outside is so dicey, then we should be dealing with why we're not getting our healthcare, proper healthcare on the outside, before we start throwing stones at prisoners who, let's face it, they lost their freedom. Granted, they did a crime, but we owe it to them to keep them healthy as a human right. And if when it comes to them being terminally ill, then I think we owe them a dignified death, no matter what they may have done on the outside. And that's a tough one for a lot of people to swallow. I know that.
Well, I'm certainly sympathetic with your view, but looking for the principle is rather hard. I mean, there's kind of two difficulties here. One is knowing what is standard healthcare. So a liver transplant, I mean, that's a pretty expensive procedure, but that's what people expect now. if they, you know, if they're in an HMO, if they have Obamacare, they should be able to get a liver transplant if there's livers out there to be transplanted. But how about cosmetic surgery? That's becoming pretty standard too now. Maybe not just breast implants or things like that, but, you know, correcting scars and so forth and so on, or sex change operations. Where do we draw the line?
Yeah, I know we should realize that I think the sex change operation, there are few and far between, although they are being asked for by prisoners. And I understand that might be a big point of contention for a lot of people. I'm not necessarily waving the flag for sex change operations to happen. I think there's other things we could do for the prisoners who are seeking transition. That's a tough one. I don't know. Maybe we need to, and they usually are separated from the general population, so it's not like they are fending for themselves 24/7 on the general or in the yard in a prison. So we are doing more non-medical things to help them deal with the fact that they're incarcerated.
So we have an email from Steve Stewart who says, "Okay, my meds cost me tens of thousands of dollars a year. I didn't hurt anyone. I should come first." Now, keep that question in mind. Let me ask you a kind of a corollary question. We pay prisoners about 17 cents an hour for the work they do. Wouldn't the sensible thing be to pay them at least minimum wage for the work they do and let them use that money to buy insurance and make their own health care decisions within their budget just like everybody else does?
That's an interesting point. I think, first of all, I don't think wages are going to go up in prison.
Probably not.
You'd have
that would give prison wages a new name, a new sense, right?
Yeah, and absolutely. And also, you have prison industries that are always constantly under attack because they're giving prisoners jobs to make desks and chairs for federal offices, and that's kind of people on the outside say like, why are they getting jobs when we can't even get a job out here? So all these options are fraught with there's a lot of things that can go wrong with these other options. But Steve who emailed, yeah, absolutely, I can see where he's spending tens of thousands of dollars for his medical, and here we are, administering medications to prisoners who have committed crimes. And again, I have to go back on saying, like, okay, Steve, I mean, why are you spending so much money on your health care? I think the problem is on the outside, not on the inside.
Right, right. There's an injustice in our health care system, but that doesn't mean we want to magnify the injustice by increasing the injustice to prisoners. We've got a caller, Dave from San Francisco, is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave. What's your comment or question?
Well, my issue is one that you have just touched on somewhat, which is the priority that should be given to prisoner health care compared to the priority that should be given to other social problems, such as health care for the unemployed. There are a lot of things that I would rank a lot more important than health care for prisoners. And health care for prisoners, I would subdivide into truly essential, maybe palliative care at end of life with drugs that would relieve pain being higher priority, or cures for infectious diseases that have highly effective and inexpensive cures having higher priority, and things like sex change operations and very, very costly drugs having lower priority. I'd be interested in Daniel's comments.
Dave, I get your thing. Thanks for the question, but I want to push back a little bit on this line of reasoning, because I think there's one thing about the prison system. When you put somebody in prison, take them away from society at large, you have total control over them. You have the capacity, if you so choose, to have like a Nazi concentration camp style thing. You have total control over them. When you take total control over another human being, I think you owe it to yourself, to your society at large, to exercise great caution in how you exercise that total control over it, over another human being. In some sense, the prison system is inimical to human dignity and our commitment to human rights. So we can't just say, well, these are the diminished humans and we don't owe them anything. If we, and they're less lesser priority, especially when you take them into total custody and exercise total control. You owe it morally, both to yourself, to your society at large, and to them, to exercise that total control with great caution. Otherwise, you're turning into a tyranny. And what do you guys think about that? I mean,
I'd suggest, as a working principal, I'd like to hear what Edgar thinks. The other place where the government, you know, more or less takes charge of a person's life is the military. And we expect that if you're in the military, the government, you've made a deal and you expect them to take care of you. So whatever is deemed reasonable health care for the military, it seems to me prima facie ought to be the standard we expect in prison. And there's debates about sex change operation, cosmetic surgery in the military. That's fine. But whatever the decision is, seems to me it should apply in prisons as well.
What do you think, Edgar?
Well, I think what you said earlier about the health care and the cost of health care, the caller brought up the fact that there should be priorities put. The truth is, I think when people are imprisoned, we should realize that the vast majority end up leaving, going back out into society.
Right.
So for us to deny them proper health care prior to them leaving is just setting ourselves up for a disaster on the outside. So I think, again, I have to go back to the fact that the health care in corrections is a human right. And let's face it, a lot of prisoners do get good health care, standard health care. I'm not saying outstanding. And there are some outstanding cases that do receive drugs that are like, you know, thousands of dollars per pill. And I see a lot of people complain that how can this prisoner get this when I can't? But I think on a very basic level, we need to maintain standard health in prison because, like I said, the vast majority of these people are coming back out into society. They are going back into their families.
Along those lines, it seems that one way we might look at it is de-ethicize it a little but every citizen, we should think, or everybody living here in America, is a potential asset to our society. And to be an asset, you need repairs. And some people, people who commit crimes, I think the assumption ought to be that for one reason or another, they're screwed up in some way that in most cases can be turned around,
well,
given enough time.
So in that case,
you don't say, Look, suppose you're hurt and you've got a car with a dent, you get the dent repaired. Well, suppose you've got a car with a broken clutch. Well, that costs more. You have to take it out of service for a while, but you still get it repaired. So that's one way of looking at it.
I think you're right, and I think there are places in the world that have more of that view of prison system. In preparing for this show, I was doing some comparative research on Germany and Europe versus the U.S., and their prison system is much, much humane. First of all, they don't put people in jail as much for as long for as many things, right? I mean, we kind of lock people up and throw away the key and get all the downside consequences of that and don't cope with it very well. There are many places in the world, though, that have a much more humane, much more rehabilitative, much more restorative kind of prison system. So it actually can be done. It's not like impossible, but I don't want to be in my soapbox, Edgar. What do you think?
No. It's interesting you said throw away the key because when I wrote that down when we were talking earlier, we assume that when we put somebody in prison, that's it. That's done. They're just throw away the key and don't bother rehabilitating them. And I think that's what's biting us right now. After decades and decades of throwing away the key, taking programs away, taking education out, and lowering the healthcare standards in prison, suddenly are we surprised that all this is happening all of a sudden?
Right. Like, I mean, if we're going to throw away the key and people aren't going to get out, you know, we think then healthcare and all this education we don't need it. But if we don't do those things for those people, then we're more inclined to want to throw away the key because we can't let these people out, right? Because they're angry and alienated, and it's just a vicious cycle.
But you also have to remember that these people in prison have families on the outside. Now, let's say, I don't know what percentage probably burned bridges with their biological families, but there are a vast majority of prisoners who still have contact with their families, and they have families members on the outside who do care about their health care. And they're constantly advocating that, like, my husband's not getting this diabetes drug. There are hundreds and hundreds of cases constantly going on between prisons and the families on the outside dealing with health care. So, yeah, the throwaway the key thing, if you have somebody in prison, If you have a family member in prison or a loved one, the throwaway the key thing is absolutely an affront to your
right.
survival.
We've got a caller in line. Ariane from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy, Dr. Ariane.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just want to comment that at the beginning of the show, you were talking about how the government has fumbled and made mistakes to be in right relationship to prisoners. And I want to write in and underscore the paradox of that, because basically Americans and our prison policy, we have a tendency to punish others for their mistakes, and we have the assumption that some mistakes are unforgivable. And you can see, you know, 2.3 million prisoners that we have, one quarter of the world's prisoner population, more than China, in fact, where you have a more homogeneous population in terms of race, how this system is a form of institutionalized racism. And then the second comment that I want to make is that, you know, prisoners, they're just treated like garbage, and they have so much idle time on their hands, and this leads to a certain kind of despair and disability that is going to ensure that when they're released at the end, often with ruptured ties to their family or neighborhoods, if they had any good ties before they went, so they're going to be released with their $200 homeless. And what is that going to mean? That's going to be a drug relapse.
Yeah.
Further desperation and enforced criminality. And then we justify these people who are like that, who live like that. We dismiss them, seeing...
Ariane, you've made lots of good points. I thank you for the call. I'm going to give Edgar a chance to respond before the break. Thanks for the call. What do you think, Edgar?
Well, let me just add my two cents while we get Edgar back. I think our thinking about this issue, like a lot of issues, suffers from focusing a kind of reason I call focusing on extreme cases. Looking for necessary and sufficient conditions that apply to everyone, as opposed to trying to get clear what we should do in paradigm cases. If you say you're against the death penalty, somebody's going to say, well, you know, why should someone with no discernible problems in life who shoots and kills three or four people, why shouldn't they be killed? Or how about Hitler? Shouldn't he have been given the death penalty? And that's focusing on extreme cases. And I think the things they say, well, maybe so, but in the paradigm case, that's not the way it works. In the paradigm case, the person who is a felon, as commits a felony, you can trace things in their upbringing, maybe in their genetics, maybe in their mental faculties, maybe just bad luck, that you can focus on, and isn't the reasonable thing to do to repair that. So I think part of the whole system, and you can see this in the way politicians talk, is just based on, well, any principle you bring up, we take the most extreme case and see if we can't refute it. But that's not the practical problem we have as a society. It's what to do with the paradigm cases, with the ordinary cases.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about dignity, rights, and life in prison with Edgar Behrens, director of Prison Terminal, The Last Days of Private Jack Hall.
What changes should we make to the prison system to make it a place where human dignity is respected and human potential is realized? Should all prisons have a hospice program for those who are dying? Or should we just release terminally ill prisoners serving life sentences to go back to their family?
Human dignity and the prison system, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, in prison, you've got plenty of time, but not always very much dignity. How can we change that? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is filmmaker Edgar Behrens, and we're thinking about rights and dignity in prison.
I think we're going to start with a phone call. No, we're not going to start with a phone call. Then I'm going to start with the question I had planned for you, Edgar.
Okay.
We're going to put you in charge Now, this is fictional. We're not quite that powerful. But we're going to hypothetically put you in charge of the entire prison system.
Okay.
You're going to be prison czar for a day, or maybe 2 days if you need it. So what are the top changes you would make?
Well, first and foremost, I would... you mentioned earlier the commutation process, and truthfully, the commutation process is fraught with a lot of hoops to jump through, and sadly, by the time all the hoops are jumped through and all the, you know, everything's completed, the person who is asking for commutation because of their terminally ill dies. So I think we definitely need to streamline that process where if you're terminally ill and you have family on the outside who are willing to take care of you during your last final months, that should happen as quick as possible. I know it's, you know, the whole commutation thing has become a political issue where a governor or a warden does not want to take the chance of commuting like Jack Hall's sentence, and suddenly Jack Hall at 82 is going on a murder spree.
Jack Hall at 82. Wasn't Jack Hall confined to the infirmary ward for like the last 12 years of his life or something like that?
He was. He had a heart attack 12 years earlier, and because he was somewhat weakened, he really couldn't defend himself or, you know, in the general population. So he was
Edgar, you disappointed me. I thought you were going to be more sweeping. So the commutation process needs to be fixed. But that's because we've got so many old, dying, sick people in prison.
Yeah, but he didn't say that was all he was going
to do. You know, I want you to do some radical sweeping reform of this moral nightmare that we've imposed on ourselves.
Well, I think maybe you guys, State of California, has already started that. I think you just released 6,000 nonviolent offenders, which I think is an absolutely great start. You know, I'm sure there's going to be horror stories coming out of that bunch of people leaving, but the truth is we cannot have people in prison, you know, like we can't have people in prison for nonviolent offenses that are in prison for 20, 30 years.
Right, exactly.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, comparing what Europe does, the truth is, you know, murder, if you're in for murder, you have a 20-year sentence. I think they have caps there, and... You know, here we have, you know, life without parole, which, you know, at the end of the day, it costs. I mean, if there's bean counters out there that are wondering about how much this is costing, I mean, a healthy prisoner costs $27,000 to keep in prison a year. When you start adding, talking about elderly prisoners, you're starting their costs annually at $65,000.
Wow.
So, you know, there's that money can be used. Elsewhere.
So, but the question is, Americans seem to have an allergy to European systems. I mean, you mentioned universal health care, and so many Americans, you know, like a single payer, which many European and Canadian and Canada have, and many people think, well, of course. Or you don't put people in jail for 20 years for marijuana possession or selling. And, you know, the Europeans are like, well, of course, we've been there forever. And Americans are like, oh, you're going tough on crime, yeah, guns everywhere, life sentences, death penalty. I mean, 1 out of 100 people. I think I read this right. 1 out of every 100 people? Or is it every in Texas is in prison?
I think it's not in Texas. I think it's nationwide on the average, 1 out of 100.
Well, we have a lot in prison in California, even with our reforms.
You do.
So what is it about us? Is the problem us? I mean, what is it about the American psyche and American politics that has put this insane, costly, ineffective system? Because the recidivism rate
is 60%.
Yeah, so how did we get here?
Part of it is vengeance, I think. You know, you want to punish someone constantly. The truth is, you know, you're losing your freedom when you're in prison. That is your punishment. No, you know, it shouldn't be torture. It shouldn't be lack of health care. It shouldn't be, you know, all these other horrible things that happen to people in prison. You know, granted, we can't fix everything in one fell swoop, although you did ask me what I would do in one fell swoop. But I think our society, we definitely are set on punishment until the very end. You know, I have family in Europe, and when I told them that I was making a film about prison hospice and how terminally ill patients, prisoners need to die with dignity behind bars, they were just appalled. They're saying, like, if you're terminally ill in prison in Spain, for example, you go home. You stay with your family, unless you don't have any, and they'll figure something out. But you never stay in prison to die. So yeah, our system, you know, even when you talk about taking care of terminally ill prisoners, people are pretty outraged by that.
So we've got dealing better with terminally ill patients. We've got maybe putting a 20-year cap for any conceivable crime, or at least for almost every conceivable crime. Here's one I'd like to throw up, see if you like it. And I think it ought to satisfy both sides. For most people, education is punishment, right? Most kids don't like to go to school. The older they get, the less they like going to school. There's a few of us, academics like Ken and me and you, that would really love to go to school their whole lives. But for most people, it's punishment. So why don't we say, since everyone that goes to prison is lacking something, they all have to continue in school. And this would also help the employment problem with academics, because I think most of these courses ought to be philosophy courses.
Except not the Wall Street types who defrauded the economy. They shouldn't be in school.
Well, they're the extreme cases and should just be shot. Well, maybe. Maybe not.
I don't know.
Should be educated. They should be educated in values. They should be educated in philosophy.
These are the programs that we've taken away.
We've taken away these programs.
Probably the most low-cost way of rehabilitating people we've taken out, because I think a lot of people on the outside say, wait a second, my son and daughter can't go to college. Why should these guys learn,
So that's back to a fundamental problem. There's so much injustice and inequality in American society, and people feel so beleaguered that they think they don't want to at first address the prison population. They want to, but I don't think it's an either-or thing. I think it's a both-and thing. But, you know, we have a caller, probably one last caller. Julian from San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Julian.
Thank you. Would you agree that one of the legitimate purposes of the penal laws is to punish, and therefore people who commit depraved crimes such as, say, killing the civil rights workers in Mississippi or abducting the polyclass girl deserve to be punished by, among other things, life imprisonment and death in prison?
Thanks for the call, Juliana. Personally, I'm not sure. I agree that punishment is one of the functions of the prison system. But go back to something I said at the when you take over a person's total life, when the state especially takes over total control of a person's life, if you don't want that state to become a morally horrible thing, that state better exercise great care when it's given that, because that power can expand. So I don't think we should think there's a set of diminished human beings that we don't care what the state does to them. I just don't think we should go that way. Well, what do you think, Edgar?
You're right. I agree with you totally. It's a slippery slope. The truth is, yeah, and I know there are a lot of victims out there who say, like, how can we care for these people on the inside in prison when, the victims, I can see the victim's point of view saying, like, these people should be punished to the very last minute. And I can see why they say that. And the truth is, with hospice, prison hospice, and I should also say that it's not only for elderly prisoners. There are many young prisoners who are dying of colon cancer or whatever just because they had the misfortune of being terminally ill.
Hey, Edgar, I want to say something before you leave.
Sure.
We're getting to the end. I want people to see your documentary, Prison Terminal, The Last Days of Private Jack Hall. Where can people see that now?
You can see Prison Terminal. It's on HBO through March of this year. It's been on HBO for the last 18 months.
Right.
If you are an educator and you want to use the film in class, you can visit the CinemaGuild.com in New York City, and they're the distributor right now for Prison Terminal. It's a 40-minute film, which is actually pretty ideal for a classroom setting.
Jack Hall did some, from what I gather, did what I regard as a pretty brutal crime out of anger and love for his son, but it sounded like a pretty brutal crime. But the humanity of that man that shines through in your documentary and the humane treatment he receives by other prisoners, all of them, I think, or many of them, those hospice workers, aren't all of those prisoners lifers in that film?
Yes, they all are lifers, yeah.
And the dignity and the humanity that they show to each other shows you that these people in prison aren't just the diminished other. They are still recognizable human beings whose humanity, when we look at them and don't just turn our eyes, cries out to us.
Absolutely. But, you know, also I should say that, I made this film also to counteract, and I know this is like a one grain of sand on one side of the balance on the scale, to counteract the sensationalistic programming that we see hourly on TV. You have shows like Lockdown USA that really just show the most heinous side of everyone in prison. And I think people on the outside assume that everyone in there is exactly like that. You know, the vast majority of people in prison are, let's face it, they've done something bad. And they're all, a lot of them are just in there to do their time. But they're not all these hyped up, sensationalistic, horrifying criminals that you see on these shows that we are swallowing every night on TV.
I mean, it's clear that prison has the capacity to transform a human life, sometimes, you know, for the better, and oftentimes, if not done well, for the worse. And we should choose the way of doing this that transforms human lives for the better, not for the worse, it seems to me.
Yeah, and you know what? The thing is, and I'm sorry to go back on the whole hospice thing, but this is a program that costs nothing. So a lot of people on the outside, when they hear that, they're like, okay, that's great. We don't have to shell out for this. No taxpayer money have to go into this. It's true. And this, the payback for a program like this, because you're training prisoners to be hospice volunteers, and they go through a 14-week training program, so they're very well-versed in end-of-life care, that transforms those prisoners. And then
right.
Those prisoners transform other prisoners out in the yard who are not necessarily involved in hospice directly.
So Edgar, that's just been a fascinating conversation. I could talk to you a lot more. I love your documentary, and I recommend everybody see it. But right now, I have to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Our guest has been Edgar Behrens. He's a filmmaker whose 2013 documentary, Prison Terminal, The Last Days of Private Jack Hall, was nominated for an Academy Award and is still playing on HBO. And you should go see this if you care about this issue. So, John, you have one last quick thought?
Yeah. I think Leviticus had good advice. We ought to have proportional punishment. And sometimes we seem to have lost sight of that. So that's my last thought.
Well, you know, this is a complicated issue. We had a great conversation. But, you know, this conversation continues. It's already started at our blog, Philosopher's Corner, on our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, Cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, a man who leaves his dignity in the dust. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, there's been a lot of head-scratching and hand-wringing lately about America's prison system. So many issues. The death penalty, is it justified? If it is justified, why are we having such a hard time finding the right lethal cocktail to kill people humanely? What was wrong with the firing squad, hangman's noose, or guillotine? Were there customer complaints? What does humane killing even mean? Or to say it the way pundits say it these days, what does humane killing look like? Are there too many people in prison in America? Not enough? Should prisons be privatized? Are our maximum security prisons perhaps too maximum? Why can't we close Guantanamo? What is the goal of prison? Rehabilitation or punishment? Do we have too many prisons, too many prisoners, not enough? Certainly save on Social Security payments. And it is certain that an obsession with prison occupies a hefty chunk of our culture, with escape, for one thing. From the Count of Monte Cristo to Papillon, even into the future with Guy Pearce, Ray Liotta, and Christopher Lambert getting away from the ungetawayable, we even have vast populations breaking out or trying to with Stalag 17, Hogan's Heroes, Von Ryan's Express, The Great Escape, Chicken Run. Then there's Cool Hand Luke, Escape from Alcatraz, Life After Prison, and The Getaway, The Blues Brothers, Jailhouse Rock. As always, coming of age, women in prison movies had a certain appeal. Of course, this was back when we had drive-ins, so you'd either drink warm beer or make out with a girl, maybe both. Only pay attention to the movie if there was a fight. Girl fights were the main attraction of women in prison movies. There was also usually a shower scene. Other virtues, Fernanda McKee or Pam Grier. There was Red Heat with Linda Blair, which I have seen for some reason. Not to mention women's prison, with the fabulous Ida Lupino as the sadistic warden. There are prison movies you don't think of as prison movies, like Blade Runner, which is about escaped convicts, isn't it? And Chicago, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Not to mention Escape from New York, Manhattan is jail. What does that say about America? What about the rash of Vietnam POW rescue movies with Chuck Norris and Sylvester Stallone? What about Deer Hunter? Let us not forget Bridge Over the River Kwai, 48 Hours, Con Air, The Defiant Ones, White Heat, Breakout with Charles Bronson, The Longest Yard, Death Race, Alien 3, Holes, Birdman of Alcatraz, My Cousin Vinny, Stir Crazy, Grand Illusion, The Fugitive, Out of Sight, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, and on television, snippets of Breaking Bad, Every Other Mission Impossible, Barney Miller, and if you'll recall, much of the Andy Griffith Show took place in the local jail, with Otis, the town drunk, even having his own key. Lock yourself up, will you? Let yourself out when you think you've been punished enough. The libertarian approach to crime and punishment. Going forward, what would that look like? Fewer prisons or more? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
And Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topit, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true or reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Barney's in jail, Barney's in jail, Barney's in jail.
Oh, yes.